old British girl found unharmed in a car with the bodies of her parents has told French police how scared she was. Zeina Al-Hilli hid for 8 hours after three people were shot dead around her. Prosecutor Eric Mayo says she wasn't able to provide many details.
She just talked about her fear, terror, and at the beginning of this carnage, she just rushed under the knees of her mother. She is likely to go back to the UK quite soon.
Her seven-year-old sister remains in a coma, while French investigators are in London to interview her uncle about claims of a feud, which he's denied. These people from the family's hometown of Claygate in Surrey say the community has been rattled.
I think that people are really shocked because this is a very nice village and nice things happen here.
These two girls are going to need the full blanket of local support. We're going to try and help them as much as we can.
In other news, Prince Harry is back in Afghanistan for a second tour of duty. His last deployment was a secret until foreign media blew his cover. This time, details have been made public. He'll be there for 4 months. Teachers have voted in favour of strike action. The National Union of Teachers says 82.5% of those balloted backed a walkout. The turnout for the vote was 27%. Really Wild Show presenter Terry Nutkins has died at the age of 66. He'd been diagnosed with leukaemia less than a year ago. Meanwhile, the new Health Secretary, Jeremy Hunt, has become the latest politician to be booed by crowds at the Paralympics. It happened as he went to present Britain's Rachel Morris with a bronze medal. That's the latest. I'm Richard Suchet.
BCFM 93.2 is a charity and works with the diverse communities in Bristol. So please continue to support us by getting involved and spreading the word. 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 Spreading the word.
Hello, Bristol, and welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. Tony Gosling, and helping us review this week's news is the candidate for the Mayor of Bristol, George Ferguson. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. In the second hour after six, the Arab Spring has meant a big turnaround for Egypt. Or has it? New President Mohamed Morsi sacked some of the top generals, but then went on to take the NATO position and attack the Syrian regime in a speech last weekend. We try to untangle the truth behind the smokescreen in Egypt. Plus, See No Evil, Hear No Evil is one of Bristol's most successful, well, the first part anyway, city centre arts events ever. How much public money went into the project and where did it all go? We talked to one city centre proprietor that wants some answers. Also, anniversaries, 15 years since the death of Diana, and also it's the 11th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks next week. We look at the reasons both these events need urgent reassessment and why we can't rely on our mainstream press anymore to do the right thing. Also, Saddam, Gaddafi and Bashar al-Assad, all Arab leaders who've been accused of bombing their own people, and where the Israelis and NATO want to go in a humanitarian mission to save the people, with disastrous results, and so far with civilian casualties into the millions. But is this idea of killing your own people something that originated here in the West? We hear more this week from former Fleet Street journalist, and he was also a Tory member of the European Parliament for Bristol, Richard Cotterill, as he takes us further into NATO's darkest secret, Operation Gladio, which he's just written a book all about. Plus the latest from around the world with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. That's all in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecasts from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 11 Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs of 23 Celsius, sunnier on Saturday, slightly cloudier on Sunday. Next week, highs of 21 Celsius, plenty of showers this week and some sunny spells, cooler midweek. Next weekend, that's the 15th and 16th of September, highs of 20 Celsius and fairly sunny. That's next weekend. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news is candidate for Mayor of Bristol, George Ferguson. Hi, George, and welcome to Drive Time.
Thanks, Danny.
Now, I don't say independent because you're a merchant venturer, aren't you? I mean, this is something which hasn't really been reported much in the Evening Post. You say you're an independent candidate, but are you actually going to continue as a merchant venturer after you're elected, if you're elected?
No, I've already said that if elected, when elected, I shall certainly leave the Merchant Adventurers. Not that I actually think that's a real conflict of interest, but there is a perceived conflict of interest. But interestingly, also, the Police and Crime Commissioner candidate for the Labour Party is a Merchant Adventurer, so make no assumptions.
Yeah, why do you think the Evening Post haven't gone big on this? Because, I mean, it is a very powerful organisation, certainly in financial terms, isn't it?
Well, I think its power is grossly overestimated. I think it used to be a powerful organisation, and it used to have a slightly dodgy history. But now, I think everybody is there for charitable purposes. I see it as a perfectly benign organisation that is only there for the best interests of Bristol, which is what I stand for.
So how do you actually get involved with the Merchants? Is it just a load of dinners, or do you have formal meetings too?
Well, I was invited to join. In fact, I was told I'd been elected even before I was invited.
It always sounds like the Hotel California, where you can't say no.
You can't say no. But presumably you can say no, but very few people seem to, because it's seen as a bit of an honour if you are somebody who operates in Bristol, and it's an honour that's given to people who seem to make a significant difference to Bristol. So it would have been a bit trite, I think, to have turned it down. And I am generally in favour of the things that the Merchants do for Bristol, which are charitable for the elderly, for the young, for education. I'm not saying it is all perfect, but and by being in there, and I can influence the way that money is spent.
But how does it manifest itself? As I said, is it sort of dinners, formal meetings? What do you do?
Well, I don't go to many dinners. There is a quarterly meeting that is the most significant decision-making time. Those I generally go to, where there's a lunch. And otherwise, I don't attend very much. And I'm prepared to be very critical of the things that I disapprove of.
Okay, can you give us an example of anywhere at the moment where you're sort of not necessarily in line with the Merchant Venturer Party view?
No, I'm out of line with the view on the redevelopment of the Territorial Army site on White Ladies Road, which that is currently up to be sold to a developer who wants to develop a supermarket and student housing, and I'm strongly opposed to it. And I've said so both within the Merchants, and I say so publicly. And I'm opposing the planning application when it comes up, because I think that it's a misuse of the site, both in terms of use, and I think it's very, very inappropriate in terms of the cars that it will draw to the site, the visual, the aesthetics of that site in White Ladies Road in a very key position. It's adding to the supermarket culture that I strongly oppose, that is damaging our independent culture and character of our streets. So it's something that you may gather that I'm not entirely friendly about.
Okay. Don't you think, though, it might be better for you to stay on as a merchant, you know, batting these causes within the Merchant Ventures if you do get elected?
I think when I get elected, I think they might want to ask me occasionally to come and give my opinion on things. So whether I'm a member or not, I think I might be able to wield a little bit of influence.
Okay. I mean, given that these mayor elections are taking place, you're one of the few, you know, four or five favoured candidates potentially. What's your vision for the city?
I think we have a wonderful city. I mean, I've always said I think we are the best city outside London. You can't compare us to London, but you can compare us to all the other core cities in England. And to my mind, we're undoubtedly the best city. But I don't think we're the city that's done the best for ourselves. I think that we've messed around with party politics, that we've had infighting, and we've not got on with things in the way that I believe we should do. So my vision for the city is to make quite sure that I spend my time out there beating the drum for Bristol, making sure that everybody knows where Bristol is, what it stands for, and that it's a great place to be. And that will be in London, in Europe, across the world.
So, I mean, we all know where it is, but what does it stand for?
Bristol is one of the most varied, interesting cities. It's one of the most diverse cities, both geographically, architecturally, socially, racially. It has a really, really interesting mix. And I want to champion that mix. And I think that the more we build on that diversity and interest, the more interesting city we will have, and the more a city we will have that everybody wants to come and see. So I think that my vision for Bristol is making it a city that everybody feels proud of within the city. That is transformational. I want to make it a city that everybody feels that they belong. Everybody has to belong. And I think too many people feel they don't belong to their own community, and they don't really feel a strong association and love for Bristol. And I think that somehow generating that feeling is a really, really important transformational issue.
Well, we've got a big ethnic minority community, as you said here, much of which is from former colonies, particularly the West Indian community. And I come back to the merchants again, because they were key people involved in the triangular trade, the slave trade, where people were kidnapped basically in Africa, taken over to the Caribbean and sold as slaves. And yet that was done in quite a nasty way, wasn't it? Because nobody really knew, or very few people in Britain and in Bristol knew what was going on. These ships would sail off. They would do their dirty work, and then they'd come back with sugar to Bristol. And I mean, this is really something. You were saying earlier, oh, they've got a bit of an iffy past. I mean, this is horrific. And the previous people who were doing the merchant venturous jobs were called the merchant adventurers. They were basically abolished by the king before the merchant venturers were set up, because they were monopolists. So there's a lot of questions about this kind of merchant elite of the city.
Well, that's
but particularly though, would you address this issue of the slave trade?
Yeah, I mean, I'm absolutely aware of that. There couldn't have been anything nastier than the slave trade. It was absolutely appalling. And the myth that slaves used to walk around the city of Bristol, there were very few. And so you're absolutely right. It was a hidden extremely nasty trade, and people were profiting out of people's misery, and that is absolutely inexcusable. And I was one of the leaders of demonstrations against apartheid when the city was sending trade missions to South Africa, and citing the slave trade as a very good reason why we should not have been dealing with a state that separated its people by colour. And so I've always been a very strong campaigner against that sort of treatment, that division of people by religion, by colour, by creed. And I believe Bristol is richer for having that variety, and I want to celebrate that. I think that's absolutely vital part of our character. It's a character that's changed since the Second World War, but it's not one that's made us a lesser place. I think it's one that's made us a much greater place.
Well, if you do become mayor, you will be able to override what our elected city councillors say they will have to get an 80% majority against you. This is a lot of power. Evening Post even talked about it as potentially a dictatorship. Now, with the central government, what we've seen is we've seen a bunch of people come to power, with David Cameron promising no top-down reorganisation of the NHS, for example, and then doing precisely that after he's elected. What guarantees can you give us that you will do what you say you will do? Because it's a great deal of power you'll have after November if you get in.
I will do what I say I will do. I'm not going to make any stupid promises. I think some stupid promises are being made at the moment, and I think they're undeliverable, some of them. And I think it's absolutely vital that you can only believe people who make credible claims. And I'm absolutely determined, and I've always stood for this, that I would want to grasp as much power as I possibly can, power and resource from the centre, from central government, for the benefit of Bristol. But I don't then want to personally wield all that power. What I want to do is then distribute that power fairly. I think, first of all, I want to have a step change in the way we perceive our governance in Bristol. I've said that I want to change the council house to being City Hall. Now, that has been seen as just a change in name. It's much more significant than a change in name. The council house somehow implies that the power lies with the council, and the council house belongs to that council. I travel a lot. When I go to places, I like to go to city halls, and I like to go to city halls that feel that they are democratic and belong to the people. And so I, you know, recently I was in Hamburg. In the Hamburg City Hall is like a marketplace. It belongs to the people. And so I think the step change is that the mayor belongs to the people. The mayor doesn't belong to the council. The mayor is the representative of the people, all the people of Bristol, who elected the mayor right across city. That's the first time that's ever happened. And I think, so the mayor's position has got to be more in the community than in the council itself. I believe that councillors are elected as local councillors. I want to see them championing their local areas. I think that they should be the leaders of their neighbourhood partnerships. They should be claiming the resources and the finance to do the things in their neighbourhoods that they believe should be done. And I think we should be devolving as much power, resource and responsibility as is possible,
but George,
down to those.
George, this isn't a devolution of power, is it? What's happening in November? I mean, essentially, what's going to be happening by the new year? Bristol's going to be being run by a handful of people. It's going to be being run by you or whoever is an elected mayor. A police and crime commissioner and a chief constable are going to be very, very powerful. Those three people can do almost whatever they want. And like I say, going back to this whole business of the elected councillors, that they will have to get an 80% majority in order to stop something that they don't feel is in the interest of the city.
Yeah, I want to work very closely with the council. I don't want to set up some sort of division between the mayor and the council in terms of policy. I want to inspire people on the council that they should make all their decision-making on the basis of putting Bristol first and putting their parties behind them. I think that this has been the problem on the council, and I think there are some good people there who are there because they do believe in Bristol and they want to serve Bristol well, they want to make Bristol a better place, but their hands are tied behind their backs by party policy, and that is what I want to break. So I want to identify those good people to become deputy mayor, to become assistant mayors, to form the cabinet that I intend to make, that will be quite a tight cabinet. And then all the other councillors have that wonderful role, and it's one that I had in the 70s, of representing their local area, the people who elected them. And for them, that is going to be a much more fulfilling role than playing some sort of local type of Westminster role that I think some of the councillors believe they're currently in.
Now, you mentioned there used to be a councillor. Am I right in thinking you were a Liberal? I mean, because in a way there'll be a lot of people saying, well, he's just really a Liberal Democrat. He's not really an independent councillor, mayor candidate at all.
Yeah, I'm very independent. Anybody will know me that I'm very independent in the way I do everything. I got elected as a Liberal councillor in 1973 when I was a kid. I was the youngest councillor. I was the first of the councillors that wasn't in the Tory or Labour parties. And but I was an independent. I hadn't even joined the Liberal Party when I was elected. And there was, in those days, there was no real party control, and we made it up as we went along. So my history is one of being an independent. I got out of party politics in the 80s deliberately and went and did my own thing by doing things like setting up the tobacco factory. I was running my architectural practice, trying to make Bristol a better place in that way as well. And I felt that I would prefer to change things through social entrepreneurship than through politics. And it is only this mayoral opportunity that's brought me back into thinking about what I can best do for the city in a different way, in a sort of political way, although I don't like to think of it as politics. I think it's a matter of being the champion of the city, being the person that inspires people, doesn't tell them what to do, but inspires them to making Bristol a better place.
But it is, I mean, you'll have quite a big budget, won't you? Isn't it 500 million, something like that, the annual budget of the city?
It's about a billion, actually.
Is it? Twice that?
It's about twice that. But it's difficult times. We are, you know, the council at the moment is cutting about 25 million a year off that budget. So, you know, in 3 years, that will be a cut of about 75 million. And that cuts into real services. It causes real pain. It causes real pain right across the board. And I think the only way one can cope with that is to go out there and make Bristol a more prosperous city by attracting inward investment, making it easier to run prosperous business in the city, to make sure that the jobs are jobs are for local people where possible, that the money is re-spent in the city. Because what we've been really bad at, I think, is that we've attracted some of the big multiples, national multiples, that don't benefit the city properly. They pay very poor wages, have pretty poor working conditions, and they suck all the profits out of the city to their centre, and that is not really benefiting the city. I'm a great champion of those businesses that recycle their profits within the city, and that is what a healthy local economy is about.
Now, Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. Martin, before I ask you about some of the economic developments this week, can you just give us your take on this whole business of the mayor, whether it's going to be good for the democracy in the city, and whether it matters that George will be able to do, if he gets in, whatever he wants, with 80% of our elected councillors having to get together in order to stop him?
Well, it's no secret that I was opposed to having an elected mayor. I mean, I was on this show and I was on BBC saying the same thing. I mean, if you look at the actual referendum to have an elected mayor, there was only a 25% turnout.
Good turnout in the circumstances.
In the circumstances, yeah. Yes, but in no sense a mandate for having an elected mayor. I mean, if you think of the Northern Ireland peace process or Scottish devolution, for example, you had to be 50% plus one. There were lots of safeguards. So it's a big change, it's a big constitutional change. I think we're stuck with it now, clearly, and therefore, you know, it could be made to work. I can see that it might be made to work, but I think I was resistant to it because of the idea of having, you know, too much power in one person's hands, and if they're a good person, fine, but if they're not, it's like the argument against monarchy. You know, King so-and-so may be fine, but his son may be an idiot, and that's one of the problems that you're going to find with concentration of power. I think it can be made to work, and I think we're stuck with it now, and I think a lot of what the positive things George has been saying about Bristol I agree with, and it may be that we can break the logjam here and have a sensible outcome which the city is going to be happy with. But one of the problems is that you may end up with whoever wins not having a proper mandate because of the way the electoral system is, so they won't actually have majority support. And also, of course, we're not all just Bristolians. There are conflicts of interest. You can't just get the politics out of politics by being nice to people. Ultimately, there are conflicts and decisions to be taken. For example, why are we cutting? Why is central government cutting Bristol's money? Should we just accept that? Or should whoever's running Bristol be saying to central government...
I'll let you ask.
We don't accept that we should be having our money cut.
Well, let's address that directly to George.
Well, central government said that they would reward those cities that elected a mayor. I mean, that, in a way, was a bit of a bribe, and I absolutely realise that. And I have absolute respect for Martin's view about people's fears about a mayor wielding too much power. I understood the opposition to a mayor. I didn't agree with it, but I entirely understood it. And I think any mayor has got to respect the fact that there were a lot of people in this city who were concerned about that power. And any mayor that wields that power in an arrogant or aggressive manner deserves a downfall. So I think there will be a lot of eyes on the way the mayor uses that power. I know that my only desire is to work with people rather than for them. I think, you know, if I'm dealing with, say, the Muslim community, the only way I can make their lives better, and there are many ways in which their lives need to be made better, and there are lots of misunderstandings within the city and outside it about the Muslim community. So I want to be able to champion their needs, champion their causes, but I can only do that with them. I can't do it for them or to them, and I think that has got to be the attitude. So it's not a matter of wielding power for the mayor. I think it's a matter of wielding power for the people, and that's why I say the mayor has got to place him or herself in the community, not grandstand from City Hall.
George, I mean, one of the problems we're having at the moment is one of the most divided societies we've had for 100 years even here in Britain, certainly since the Second World War, with the rich getting richer and the poor getting poorer. How are you going to bring those two together? I mean, if you're going to try and work with people, you've got to be able to have the trust of both sides, haven't you?
I think so. I think, well, I think an absolute necessity is to drum up more prosperity for Bristol in terms of investment, in terms of activity across the board, whether it be in pure business or social entrepreneurship. What I think is the most difficult and most challenging and most important thing is that one spreads the benefit of that across Bristol. You know, there are certain areas of Bristol where you've got three and even four generations of unemployment, and it shows, and there is depression. I think what is really important is to aim whatever you do to make this a happier city. I want to, you can't fool yourself that suddenly you can make everybody working on the dust carts a happy person. But I think it is vitally important that we keep that in our mind all the time. It's not just about wages. It's not just about facilities. It is also about that real psychology of feeling happy with your lot. And you know, you cannot separate that from financial need. And so spreading the benefit has got to be absolutely up there as top priority with generating the economy.
Well, in the Post this week, our first story, MP's book claims Brits are lazy. A Conservative MP has defended a controversial new book that claims British workers are among the laziest in the world. Chris Skidmore is one of the five Tories who've co-authored a book which says too many Brits prefer a lie-in to working hard. The new book, called if you want to go out down to Waterstones and get hold of a copy, is Britannia Unchained, Global Growth and Prosperity. Is due to be published next Thursday, but leaked excerpts have already caused a storm. It says once they enter the workplace, the British are the worst idlers in the world. We work amongst the lowest hours, we retire early, and our productivity is poor. And this is Kingswood MP Chris Skidmore. He did not write that passage himself, apparently, but Martin, what are your thoughts about this new book, Britannia Unchained?
Well, I just say there's not a lot of macroeconomics in it, is there? It's a lot of anecdote and saloon bar talk. The fact is that the macroeconomic situation nationally and internationally is dire, and it's not about lazy British workers. It's about lack of investment and productivity in this country over 30 years, as we've had a neoliberal consensus. This stuff is fluff. It's like candy floss, and it's shocking with the seriousness of the economic situation.
Well, what he's saying essentially is that people in Britain, the conditions of work are far too good.
Well, I mean, they're talking to themselves. The reality, the failures in the British economy over the last 30 years are not to do with people not working hard enough. It's the fact that we've had massive unemployment. I mean, unemployment's never come down below a million in my adult lifetime. And that was unthinkable when I was a child. And we were talking about three generations of unemployment. Yeah. We were talking about that earlier. Mm. That does make a difference in the long run. And also, I used to work in the economic regeneration department in the city. And what used to amaze me is that Bristol is one of the most successful cities in Europe, but it still has three of the most deprived wards in the country.
Yeah, it is shocking, though.
And that just goes to what I read from that is that even a successful capitalist economy fails people, and never mind an unsuccessful one. But these people are away with the fairies, in my view.
George, the Kingswood MP, Chris Skidmore, told the Evening Post, clearly this is just a section of a book that has a wider argument, but it's important that we have an open and honest discussion about where we want the British place in the world to be, and that's why he's making these points about laziness in Britain.
Well, it's not my experience. I think that's a load of rubbish, to be honest. I mean, of course there are lazy people in all countries, and as Martin says, it's anecdotal. He's probably had an experience of one or two lazy people and then generalised, but it's an absolutely outrageous generalisation. There are so many more things that I think you can judge a nation on in any case. I come back to this question about people feeling good. I think that I would put absolutely at the top of the list. It's very difficult for people to get back into work if they have had a culture of being out of work. You can understand that, and you've got to understand it. You've got to help people to get back into a culture of work when they've been out of work for a generation or more. As a generalisation, I think it's outrageous.
On to our next story. Big Brother is watching the opera. Basil Getty, I'll try and pronounce that name right, is appointed the Arts Council's chief, a new Arts Council chief. TV executive Sir Peter Basil-Getty, the man behind such hits as Big Brother and Deal or No Deal, has been appointed chairman of the Arts Council England. Martin.
Well, what do you want me to say about it? Comment on it? It seems extraordinary to choose somebody who's basically an expert in popular television to be in the head, you know, things like what are we talking about? Basically, what do they call
it?
Big Brother, yes. Deal or No Deal. Television. I mean, reality television, it's a bit of a change, isn't it, from people who are involved in opera and symphony orchestras and so on. I'm sure the government are trying to send a message by putting somebody like that in charge of the arts. I don't think the people in the arts will be that impressed, but then I'll have to wait to hear what they have to say.
George, he was knighted for his services to broadcasting earlier this year.
Oh, was he? Well, Basil-Getty, I mean, historically, I thought it was Basil-Getty who put the drains in London. Anyway, I don't know whether he's related. But it's a tricky one, isn't it? Because I feel rather like Martin that, you know, and I have a theatre and I'm very interested in the arts and everything, that this sounds like a dumbing down.
You better be careful what you say, no, because absolutely. You may not get your next Arts Council grant if you give him a hard time right now.
All I know, he's replacing somebody who was a very good chairman of the Arts Council, searching for a name at the moment, who got sacked by Mr. Hunt because she was so good, and challenged him a bit. So I hope that this is not a yes man. I don't know enough about him to comment, apart from the fact that it's a bit strange, seeing his past is to do with these particular programmes.
What would you say generally about the state of television now? Because, I mean, he's obviously part of the high audience numbers in TV, but, I mean, audience isn't everything, is it?
Audience isn't everything. I mean, television has its highlights, doesn't it? I mean, the current Paralympics, what TV that is. I think it's absolutely brilliant and inspiring. And I don't watch TV much, but when I watch it, I need it to be really good. And I've given up on an awful lot of TV because I find it really, really boring and not really adding to my life. But and I think it's a menace because you get stuck in front of it if you're not careful. But I think the Beeb and Channel 4 do really well, and maybe I ought to say that some of the other channels, they do really well on the big events still, and that's what I enjoy.
OK, well, on a slightly different tack, but also television, let's have a listen to a little bit of TV, which maybe George missed earlier this week, but it was to do with the sport, so let's have a listen now.
Ladies and gentlemen, we now have the victory ceremony for the men's 400 metres T38. The medals tonight will be presented by the Right Honourable George Osborne MP, Chancellor of the Exchequer, who's accompanied by Mr. Chris Brownridge.
First boos that we've heard all week at the Paralympic Stadium. Nice moment for Chris Brownridge, certainly.
Yes, that was George Osborne, Martin, being booed at the Paralympics. What are your thoughts about his reception there to a rather big, you know, sort of tens of thousands of public audience?
There was a joke doing the rounds as, why did 80,000 people boo George Osborne at the Paralympics? Because that's the capacity of the stadium. Well, I mean, I think what's happening is that people are beginning to see through the government's excuses about the economy. The deficit is actually increasing as a result of the austerity policies being pursued. Sounded plausible, but it was never plausible, really. a lot of people were taken in, the scales are falling from their eyes.
Now, we've had the euro crisis bubbling on. We've got a big meeting next week. We've got the September the 12th meeting of the German court to decide whether the euro crisis is, whether the bailout, the latest bailout plan is acceptable to the German people. What are your thoughts about this announcement yesterday that the European Central Bank is going to now be allowed to start buying up this government debt around the continent?
Well, it's certainly caused a bump upwards in the market.
What's the change, anyway? What's the difference?
Basically, the European Central Bank is opting to try and behave a bit more like the Federal Reserve has done and a bit like the Bank of England has done, basically QE. They're allowed to do QE.
This is basically funny money, though, isn't it? They're printing money out of nowhere.
That would be the German view.
They're printing money out of nowhere.
The head of the Bundesbank voted against this. So the Germans are put out of joint. Their noses are out of joint about this quite seriously. But the other thing that I've been reading about it is that although he's going to buy up these bonds, they're going to what they call sterilise the money injection. So they will take money out somewhere else to make up for the money they're putting in, which rather defeats the object. So you've had a sugar rush in the markets this afternoon and yesterday as they took on board that he was going to spend loads of money. And then he said, yes, but I'm going to take it away with my other hand. It might be That might be the result by middle of week. We'll see.
So is it a bit like sort of kicking the can down the road again to make the crisis? If there is some sort of financial collapse, it will be even worse when it happens?
Ultimately, yes. I mean, that would be the argument of the super free marketeers in the von Mises Institute and so on. Ultimately, all you're doing is putting off the dreadful day and making the dreadful day more dreadful. The Germans, in a way, I have sympathy with their view. This is just another kind of bailout for the banks. Why are we doing this? But they are a bit complacent about if you don't bail the banks out, they're going to collapse.
So,
and of course, this is the kind of problems that you might be dealing with as mayor of Bristol if you took over. It's not just going to be about chugging along and moving a few things around inside Bristol. We might be facing a financial tsunami and all those kinds of things. Not that the mayor of Bristol is responsible for dealing with that, but you might be dealing with the fallout from it. And whoever wins has got to be thinking like that we could be going into something much tougher than we've already got.
George.
Somebody tweeted me a link to that little clip about George Osborne. I was rather saddened by it, actually. I thought, you know, our politics or our belief in politics has sunk so low now and in politicians, and I am saddened by it because I don't believe any politician there is there to try and do damage. I think they're trying to do their best. You may not agree with them, and however much I agree or disagree with somebody, I think that taking a Paralympic event as an opportunity to humiliate somebody was a bit sad. But
well, I mean, that's a massive audience he's got there. The other thing with George Osborne,
it was.
I mean, you can't blame any one person.
I think somebody else has been booed today as well. You know, I think it's started.
It's catching, isn't it?
It's catching. On the European front, I think it is interesting that there's been a boost in the market, which has resulted in Spain and presumably Greece and the others being able to borrow more economically because it was getting to dangerous tipping point levels. I think what's going to be interesting to see what happens, as Martin says, over the next week or two as to how it settles down and whether this is a step change or not. It sounds like a step change. It is a brave decision, and it's quite a radical one. And I'm hoping that the euro does survive because we're going to all suffer if it doesn't.
Well, these other countries such as Spain, Portugal, Ireland, Italy, I mean, they do seem, George, to be caught in this kind of death spiral of debt where the debt is piling up far quicker than they're getting any kind of tax receipts in from the public. So it does look now like it's out of control. Do you think this is actually going to be something which deals with that? Because, I mean, if they're being forced to bring in even more austerity measures, surely the tax receipts in all these countries, and including in this country, as we've seen with the actual amount of debt now going over £1 trillion under this government who was supposed to be doing something about it, doesn't really seem to be a solution.
I think it could go either way, Tony. If I knew which way it was going, I would do very well. But I honestly think it could go either way. But if it does go down, if those countries do go down, we'll all feel the effect. You know, it'll be more than ripples.
Well, Jacob Rothschild, we were reporting last week, has bet 160 odd million on the collapse of the Eurozone. So we'll see how that all goes. Anyway, we're now joined by Marina Morris. Marina, what have you got for us this week?
Hello. We have a question. Why does the UK have such a low trust score? Quality of life comes not only from material wealth. We also have a human needs to cooperate. The European and World Value Survey showed that UK trust score is about 30%. Compare this Sweden, which has the highest level of trust, this 68%. People trust each other most in Scandinavian countries and Netherlands. The lowest European level of trust is in Portugal, 10% of population trust. The all world average was 25%, meaning that we live in an imperfect world. People were asked in 2006, during the last Labour government, do you have confidence in the government? 21% in the UK answered not at all. Compare this 5% in Norway and 4% in Finland, or 31% in France, who had no trust in their government, Western Europe's least popular government at the time. Why did countries this similar average income per person have very different levels of trust between each other and between the people and government? How does this affect everyone, and who and when teaches us to be honest, decent, provide a high standards of care for others, which is a foundation of trust? A number of convincing studies in the United States have linked trust to quality of life, health, greater longevity. Trust leads to cooperation, effectiveness, camaraderie, common goods, patriotism, and loyalty. People who trust others are more likely to donate time and money to helping other people. They are supportive, feel secure, and believe in common culture, shared values that everybody should be treated with respect and tolerance. Conversely, the lack of trust has a cost and penalties. Building trust can take years, but is fragile. It can be destroyed in an instant. Individually, we are social animals and we have a need for cooperation. Distrust indirectly affects our social, physical and mental health, and directly not being trusted can affect our wealth. Classic example is the halving in the value of BP's shares after the April 2010 oil rig disaster in the Gulf of Mexico. Statistical pattern shows the link between trust and quality of life and satisfaction, and the link between distrust and health and social problem. All imperfection provide opportunities. Question, how? How can we improve trust in society? And when and where do we start? And what is the role of power, government, schools, parents?
Well, I love that sentiment, Marina, that a problem is also an opportunity. So let's have a listen now to your Vox Pop, because you were out on the streets this week asking the people of Bristol this very question.
In the European and World Value Survey, the UK trust score is about 30%, compared to Sweden, 66%. Why?
Compared to the rest of Europe, I think our society is quite closed. Like, people are very conscious and very concentrated in their lives, on their houses and their homes. Like, an Englishman's home is his castle, and they want to be inside. So what they see broadcast into their homes from, you know, radio, TV, magazines, and what have you, is this fear mongering. Like, you get in the Daily Mail of immigrants stealing our jobs, and, you know, this constant like undercurrent of racism in a lot of mass media. And so people are scared of the unknown, and they treat it as something suspicious, and they treat it as something frightening. Whereas I think in a lot of other countries, they have an open society where you see the whole family, for example, out on the street with the grandparents and the kids and so on, and things are a lot more sort of natural and healthy. And I think we just don't have that. And I also think the British do have a tendency to moan about things, and anything that's new, you just pick on it. And it's the same thing of, like, we like underdogs and we don't like anyone that does well because they think there's something suspicious about it. And I think it's really, really sad that we have such a low trust level, but I can see it. You know, people have, like, ridiculous alarm systems on their houses and cars, and it's constant, like, worrying about who are they going to break in, are they going to steal our jobs, and it's like, who is this they? But everyone seems to be frightened of of anything different, anyone who's a different colour or saying something different. And that's really sad. We should celebrate the new, and it makes me really frustrated.
I don't think the lack of trust levels in this country is a new thing at all. I think it's age old. I think with a country which progressed rather rapidly, trying to impose its power upon the rest of the world whilst only being a little island and being quite vulnerable in that, I think that's just influenced the social climate for this country for hundreds of years, and that's part of who we are.
As I mean, personally speaking, I've got a small group of people that I do trust, and anyone outside of that circle is somebody I don't know and I probably don't trust. Set the precedence, and you have to treat everybody else as though they might be.
I mean, when you compare the UK to Sweden, the population of the UK is massive compared to Sweden, so naturally there's a lot more people. So I think, you know, you keep your friendship close and that's it, really. That's all you need. So trust is important.
I think it's nice to trust people, but nowadays it's much harder to. And I think that comes from the government, because it stems from the top, doesn't it?
I think we're too easily swayed by other people too much, and I think our government probably isn't as strong as the government of Sweden.
Well, it was the European and World Values Survey, and the sort of headline figure really is that the UK trust score is about 30% compared with Sweden, which is the highest trust level, nearly 70%. Martin, why is it that we are trusting less? And do you think that as one of those commenters there was saying, that this is related what George was talking about earlier on, which is about trusting government?
Well, it is partly. I mean, Sweden basically has had a social democratic consensus for 50 years or longer. And, you know, trust is something that's built up over a long period, as Marina said in her piece, and it can be destroyed quite easily. But it's something that takes quite a long time to build up. I mean, people, you know, workers in Sweden, I think they've got something like 90% in trade unions in Sweden, and have had for years and years and years. There's hardly any strikes. They don't need to be on strike. The unions are basically in the driving seat, even when they've got a conservative government, so-called. But that's what I would say as a social democrat. When I look to Scandinavia and I see the success in those places, it's because of consistency of approach over many, many years. And of course, in Britain, what we have is a more sharp class conflict, you know, the toffs and the rest. And it's still going on, and it's been going on for a long time, as one of the contributors said.
Yeah, I think that's right. Now, I think it is sad, because I think you get much better government when there's trust. And I think an enormous challenge for the elected mayor is to earn trust. And you'll only earn that trust by being very open with people. And I think an awful lot of the trust comes from the way things are done secretly, or the perception is that things are done secretly. And I lived in Norway when I was a child, actually, when my dad was in NATO. And I've just been in Sweden and Denmark. And they are countries that do have a much more trusting feel. And I think there's less of a feeling of extreme inequality in those countries, which must, as Martin says, be part of it. But I come back to the mayoral thing. I think it's vitally important that Bristol trusts its mayor. And I think that's where I feel a certain advantage as an independent, because I think I don't bring any of that party political baggage with me, and I don't bring people who are going to be breathing down my neck telling me that I've got to go in a particular direction. And I think if you're going to have that real change of representing the people who elected you directly without interference, then you need to be independent. If you want to make the mayor just a different version of what we had before, really more of the same, then you elect a party mayor.
Okay.
And I think that in itself brings an element of distrust, because we have people who are very tribal and distrust each other's tribes.
Okay. Planning policy. Don't blame the countryside for our lack of housing. This is from Simon Jenkins in The Guardian. The government's learning curve on planning is like an ant climbing a mountain. Desperate for someone to blame for the lack of growth, David Cameron has fallen back on the Margaret Thatcher's old bogey, local government and the bugbear of planning control. This is announcing a three-year almost moratorium in making it much, much easier for people to get planning permission for various things. George, what are your thoughts about this?
I have some difficulty with this. As you know, I'm an architect. I like things to be done well. And I mean, my biggest fear is that we'll get terrible bodges and things not done very well. And the last thing I wanted to see is the green belt trodden all over, because I think it's one of the most valuable things that's come out, came out of the 1947 Planning Act, and has made this country what it is. And so I think that's vitally important. I noticed that this liberating the house extension rule is going to massively benefit those with big houses, and the bigger your house, the more you can extend
it. Well, it's also going to benefit people.
The smaller your house, the less you can extend it, which is
or if you live in the flat, there's no chance to extend it.
If you're going to live it up in the sky, you certainly can't.
There's not a lot in that policy for the homeless, is there?
Not a lot of that policy for the homeless. So I'd be a bit worried if I lived in a semi-D and the next door semi-D was just without planning permission able to extend itself without proper planning consideration.
Well, Martin, yeah. Eric Pickles has threatened to strip councils of their planning powers today. In The Guardian, the community secretary's warned he will strip local councils of all their planning powers and hand them to central government.
Well, isn't this contradictory? So it's government policy to have elected mayors, but if they do things that central government doesn't like, for example, block some developments, then they're going to have their powers taken off them and taken back to central government. It's like we'll play cricket until we're losing, and then it's our bat and it's our ball and we're not playing anymore. I mean, that is rather typical of the intellectual confusion at the heart of the government. And what I would also say is, if they think that people extending their houses in posh parts of Britain is going to put everybody to work, they're living in cloud cuckoo land.
Well, talking of houses, we're building a lot, apparently about to build anyway, on the old Frenchay site, which is going to be, according to North Bristol NHS Trust, knocked down very soon to make room for houses. And I was up there on Monday for an absolutely packed Frenchay Village Hall. You couldn't fit another person in there, to talk to Tim Bowles, who's their chairman of their parish council.
I'm here this evening to chair a public meeting so that all the residents of Frenchay and other people in the community can get together to discuss the draft concept statement regarding the future development of the Frenchay hospital site.
Okay, well, what's being proposed?
At the moment, there's some draft proposals been made by the Hospital Trust that involve the development, residential development of much of the site. It'll amount to hundreds and hundreds of new dwellings on the edge of Frenchay.
Is it just a case of NIMBYism? We don't want big new housing developments in our village?
I haven't heard that necessarily, no. A lot of people do recognise that Frenchay's got quite a broad mix of development, and you just have to walk around this remarkable village to see lots of different styles. So I don't think it's that. I think it's that people really do see this as going to have a very, very big effect on the long-term nature of the village and want to make sure that wherever possible their input can be heard.
Well, I mean, certainly one way of looking at it is just another bit of privatisation, isn't it? This was public land, George. It's now going to be taken over by developers to build houses, presumably posh luxury houses. If we're hearing, what we're hearing from the government is that they're taking away the developers' obligations to produce more affordable housing.
Yes. I mean, in principle, you want to bring as much affordable housing with every form of development. I don't understand why actually it's only with residential development. I think that the supermarkets and other people should be providing affordable housing every time that they develop. But there are cases, I think, there are special cases. There's been an interesting argument in Bristol about the Bristol General Hospital, which is an excellent scheme that is providing no affordable housing. Now, I think it's a matter of digging deep into the economics of it as to whether that is an exception or not, and I don't know what the answer is, but there are sometimes arguments where there's a particularly difficult site. But I think the big issue is we still in Bristol have the opportunity to develop brownfield sites, you know, to develop existing buildings. I can think of several cases of buildings. There's one, the chocolate factory in Easton, which people accuse me of owning, which I've never owned, and I've never had any financial interest in other than I was an architectural advisor to the owners of it. There is a wonderful opportunity to create some really interesting housing and to create a community. And I think there are lots of these opportunities around Bristol that must come before those sort of opportunities that spoil our countryside or some of the edges of the city.
OK, abandoned Severn tidal power project is to be reconsidered. The Prime Minister asked to re-examine the £30 billion scheme to build a barrage across the estuary. It promises to generate 5% of the UK's electricity. Well, that's a big promise, Martin.
Yes, I think this... I mean, I don't know enough about the technical aspects of this, but it seems to me that this is the kind of thing that the government should be doing in order to build the infrastructure of the future for this country, which is, I mean, a lot more sense to my mind than building nuclear power stations.
This is a massive project, George, isn't it?
It is a massive project. It's one I always used to be in favour of. I just wonder now, I think there are other ways that we can make use of that enormous tidal power. And I know there are other ways. And I'm not sure that having this one grand project is the answer.
Okay, what are those other ways?
Because that's there are ways of having forming sort of reefs that that are on the edges of the Severn that can do it, but not to the same extent. I mean, it's a smaller investment, obviously for a smaller return, but nevertheless, there are alternatives. I mean, I'm actually very in favour, and this is not so much a power thing, and I'm very in favour, obviously, of renewables, and it's something that I've invested a lot in myself, and I drive the car I came in here is run from the renewables, the photovoltaics on the top of the tobacco factory. So I'm very in favour of renewables. But there is another side issue. Is I'm actually in favour of having a little barrage at Avonmouth that would raise the water level, that would give us the opportunity to have water transport running through the heart of the city. So I think the barrage is an interesting one, but there are some dangers to it. There are some dangers to the operation of the port, which is very important to Bristol's prosperity, and I think there are some concerns about some of the natural history. But I think if it can be achieved in a way that solves those issues, then it is a big hit.
Okay, final story. Over 1,000 likely phone hacking victims have been identified. This is revealed this week by Sue Akers at the Home Affairs Select Committee. So let's have a listen to what she had to say on this is from the BBC's Today in Parliament.
Likely victims, which is the category that perhaps members have been more interested in, because these people are likely to have been victims of hacking. We assessed to be at 1,069, of whom 658 have been contacted.
388 were uncontactable, she told MPs, and 23 were not told they were likely hacking victims for what she called operational reasons.
£40 million of taxpayers' money, half the people haven't actually been contacted and notified, yet only 9 people have been charged. Is that a concern to you?
Sue Akers felt the fact that people had been charged showed the investigation was a success. She later clarified to the committee that 8 people had been charged over phone hacking, with a further 6 facing charges of perverting the course of justice.
Well, this is a big story. It's been rolling on for years. Martin, only half the people on that list the police have got have actually been contacted and told their phones have been hacked.
Well, at least it's being investigated, and I hope it's investigated thoroughly. And if people have been breaking the law, and that includes Rupert Murdoch, they should go to prison.
I feel very left out. My phone hasn't been hacked.
You don't know?
No, I don't know.
It might have been.
No, I think
if it became mayor, it might be.
I think that it's absolutely wonderful that it's been the downfall, or the at least the public downfall of the Murdochs and all their dreadful press. But it is an appalling, it's an appalling way to behave.
Okay, so ultimately, do you think Murdoch, what about, you know, should he go to jail, and should various more people go to jail because of this, George?
Well, I'm not to judge that. I think that is a legal matter, whether he goes to jail or not. I think he has been suitably humiliated.
Okay, that's all. We're coming up to now to the Murdoch news at 6 o'clock. Thanks to this week's guest you just heard there, candidate for Mayor of Bristol, George Ferguson. After the news, Egypt.
The community station for Bristol. Listen live online at bcfm.org.uk. BCFM News from the Sky News Centre.